This is On Target with Penny Wolfgang, a program that takes an inside look at what is happening in Western New York with news, features, and special guests. Now, here's your host, Penny Wolfgang.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to On Target, and thank you so much for joining us today. I'm your host, Penny Wolfgang, and every week we try to talk about subjects that we think are interesting and important and topical for all of us who live here in the Western New York community, and we have guests who we think are interesting, important, and topical, and who are kind enough to take time out of their busy schedule to join us on Target, and we're really grateful, especially to our guests today, because, you know, one of my favorite subjects is anything to do with law and order, because of my background and because it's me. So anytime I get an opportunity to talk about something related to our safety or to crime or to anything that's happening locally as far as safety in the schools, as far as safety training in office work, office places, I guess they call it, I'm always excited to have that opportunity. And thanks to my lovely, beautiful daughter, Robin, she told me about a man who she was very impressed with who did some active shooter training in real life for her at her place of employment and has done it at other places of employment. And the reason he knew how to do this was because, and the reason he had so many credentials to do it is because he is a former supervising special agent for the FBI. So thanks to Robin Wolfgang for Pete Orchard being here. Thank you. Okay, we always like to mention my daughter when we can. Although, I don't know if she's listening, but she'll find out.
I mention my kids as much as I possibly can.
So anyway, I was fascinated when I was talking to Robin not too long ago, and she was actually telling me about the active shooter training, but more importantly, she's telling me I worked with this man who has the most fascinating background. And you, mother, would love to meet him because you, mother, are obsessed with law and order and safety. So that is you, and that is me. And I wanted to start by telling our listeners about your background, how what you did and what supervising special agent means in the FBI.
Well, Judge, I started in Buffalo in 1995 as a special agent, basically as a street agent. I worked organized crime, narcotics, violent crime, various different squads. Worked on the Joint Terrorism Task Force for a couple of years. And then in 2009, I transferred to FBI headquarters and worked in the counterterrorism division.
Is that in Washington?
In Washington, D.C. And from there, I did transferred over to the International Operations Division, which is all the overseas operations for the FBI. So you have about, I can't remember what the exact number is, I would say 58, 59, what they call legal attachés. They're basically the FBI representatives in each of the embassies around the world. And I went over and I was the deputy legal attaché in Kabul, Afghanistan. Did that for 18 months, came back to headquarters again, got to do a year sabbatical. Got my master's degree at the Marine Corps War College, and then from there took over the FBI police, the uniform division. So I was basically the chief of the police for the FBI uniform division for over 2 years. Got an opportunity to come back to Buffalo, took the supervisory job for the Violent Crimes Against Children squad and the also the Civil Rights Program. And I had that squad until basically the Bureau kicked me out. When you hit 57, you're at mandatory age, and it was time to go and get a real job.
That doesn't sound like, and all of those sound like real jobs to us. They sound totally fascinating. And the thing is that I just got lost in 1 minute. What do you mean by uniform? There's uniformed FBI agents?
So have you ever been to the White House?
Yes.
You ever see the guys in uniform outside
yes.
the White House? They're what they call Secret Service Uniform Division. FBI police is the same type of setup. They're law enforcement officers. They're federal law enforcement officers. And I had a 252 sworn officer force spread out over four states.
And so they're trained FBI agents as if
No, they're trained police officers.
As police officers.
So they're trained in Glencoe, Georgia, where a lot of the other training's done, and they're actually uniformed police officers. And I had 16 explosive detection canine dogs. So it was. So if you go to the FBI Academy, it's FBI police. If we go to a campus out in Clarksburg, West Virginia, and then we had the New York and Washington field officers also had FBI police.
Tell me about when you mentioned the different areas that you were specializing in or that you were assigned to. Tell us about, I think everyone around here always wants to know about organized crime because they think, I don't know, Buffalo is a hotbed of organized crime according to the media and according to history. And then all of a sudden it is or it isn't, but there's been a lot of associations over the years with the Buffalo area.
In the 1970s, Buffalo is one of the 25, what they call the Cosa Nostra, LCN families throughout the country. And it was a pretty powerful family at the time. And then in the, I'd say the early 90s, they'd been into some of the unions. And Department of Justice did basically a civil RICO on the Laborers Local International, and that caused them to kind of be separated out of there. That kind of broke their piggy bank, and from that point on, it really diminished a lot of their power. In the 90s, we didn't really see anybody coming up through the ranks. It was pretty much the older guys from the 70s, and it kind of died out when those guys ended up. I think most of them, almost all of them, are dead now. So there was really nobody coming up through the ranks to take over.
So why are they blaming issues that they have in Canada on us?
I've talked to a couple, you know, the old timers who really worked these guys in the 70s and 80s, and as far as we can tell, it's almost a made up story. Even if it were true, the fact that the boss of the Montreal family would dictate what Buffalo's going to do in the United States is just, it's farcical. Nobody's ever worked organized crime would ever believe that. These guys would not foul somebody from Montreal. So we're not really sure where that story came from. We do know that the Buffalo family had a lot of influence on the Hamilton families. And that kind of dates back to World War II. The Canadian government locked up all of the Italian, La Cosa Nostra, in Canada at World War II. Kind of almost like we had interned the Japanese, you know, beginning of World War II and all that. They locked them all up. And one of the main guys, Johnny Papalia, who ran pretty much southern Ontario, needed somebody to watch out for his, you know, the gambling rackets and all the other stuff that they were into. Somebody had to watch over that, so they made a deal with the Buffalo family to watch over that. Part of that is they had to pay them money. You know, they got a cut of running those rackets while these guys were locked up. When they came back out, they still had to pay money to them. So that's where they are there. But as far as a Montreal family controlling, they do know a Montreal family is exercising a lot of control in Hamilton now, and that's where you're seeing the shootings, and it looks like they're trying to clean house. But as far as any impact on Buffalo, well, we have no idea where that story would even come
from. Well, we like to hear the real scoop from you because we don't want to get a bad reputation in Buffalo. We got enough troubles with things that are really true, you know, bad weather and things like that. We certainly don't want a reputation for having organized crime. I wanted to say that from the time that you were involved in the organized crime, things have issues. That is, things have really changed as far as like law enforcement, FBI, and so forth, as far as the focus. And it's probably totally terrorism at this point.
I think it was after 9/11. You know, I was on a violent crime squad and went over to the Joint Terrorism Task Force in early 2002. And a lot of guys did. A lot of offices cut their gang squads. L.A. specifically, L.A. you know, used to be the big, you know, Bloods and Crips gang capital of the world. And I can't remember how many gang squads they had, but they cut themselves down significantly and took those guys and put them on joint terrorism task forces. I think in probably the last probably 6 or 7 years, that's kind of swung back a little bit more back into the criminal side. You know, the communication's a lot better, interagency in between, you know, local, you know, county, and federal law enforcement. It's almost, I don't want to say it's a well-oiled machine, but there's a lot more tools available, and they have swung some of the, you know, I think manpower back towards the criminal side. You know, a big growth area for the Bureau is cyber. There's a lot more people in work in cyber. But again, the violent crime's still up there. You know, I always used to say, it doesn't matter if you get killed by a terrorist or you get killed by a Crip. The bottom line is you still got killed.
Got killed, right.
So, and the people on the street, that's what, you know, so that's kind of where I think it's swung back. And I think it's probably at a pretty good balance now. We used to think there was too many people working terrorism, you know, guys stepping on each other's cases and that type of thing. And I think it has swung back. But, you know, after 9/11, it had to. I mean, everybody had we could not have another attack on U.S. soil, period. Couldn't happen.
And right now, I just want to interrupt for a moment in case you just tuned in. By the way, you are listening to On Target with your host, Penny Wolfgang, and our guest today is former supervising special agent. You said that was a mouthful.
I told you it was.
For the FBI, Peter Orchard, and we're just learning so much about our listeners about, you know, what the issues are and what the problems are and how law enforcement deals with it. I wanted to, when you mentioned before about cyber, when you said one of your activities, one of your functions at one point was crimes against children, was that involving cyber crimes or was it another kind of crime?
It's cyber to the extent that almost 90% happens over the internet.
That's what I thought.
You know, with all the different social media apps now, one of the big ones we would see a lot is what we call sextortion. And it's usually targeted at, you know, 13, 14-year-old girls. Yeah, it's a real vulnerable time in her life. They start getting into a chat with a guy online. And, you know, right or wrong, might send some photographs that probably aren't appropriate to him. And she thinks it's this 18-year-old gorgeous guy, first guy that's really, really showing her, you know, kind of attention, even though it's a 40-year-old degenerate living in his mother's basement. And once that photo's out there, yeah, well, I use Snapchat or whatever. No, it's still out there. He gets a hold of the photo, and then he comes back and says, if you don't send me more photos, I'm going to tell your parents. I'm going to send these to your parents. And these guys are masters at, you know, manipulation online. And she'll send more, and then he'll be the same guy, but he'll pose. Let's say his name was Bob. Now he's going to pose as Dave. And he'll come back in and say, this is Dave. I can protect you from Bob, but you have to meet me. And
what a scenario. Like, it's hard to believe these things really happen. I think our listeners are probably going, what? How could this really happen?
Case like that happened in Cheektowaga.
I know. And
you know, as a judge, I mean, you've seen them.
But it seems so incredible that, like you said, that young people would be doing this and that they would fall for it and that adults would be that dangerous. Can't think of another word.
I think the adult side of it, I think those guys have always been out there. The internet gives them so many different avenues now to get more victims and that type of thing. The biggest thing we'd always say, and we'd give kind of presentations like this, the PTAs and all this other stuff, would be, as a parent, you know, this isn't a Disney Channel, all right? Well, I respect my kid's privacy. It has nothing to do about your kid's privacy, but you bought the phone, you're paying the bill, you have a right to see what's on your kid's phone. All right. And I'm not saying you're the helicopter parent that looks at every single email they get, but you better be looking at what apps they have. What does this app do? Why do you have this? That type of stuff, because maybe that little invasion of privacy there will pay you big dividends on the other end. Because once this girl gets trapped in that, a lot of times they can end up raped. They can end up abducted. I mean, there's a whole myriad of really, really bad things that can happen on the other end. And I hate to say that, but that's the world we live in nowadays.
It must have been quite different for you as time went by from your original training and what you were doing in the FBI when you first started to now, the more recent times.
Oh, it's immensely different. I mean, we went from when I first started, I didn't think we had a cell phone. I mean, I hate to show my age here, but really, and then a few years into it, you got the kind of the brick cell phone, and then I remember when we went to BlackBerry's and we had the, a mobile device there, and all of a sudden everybody, like for SWAT training, we'd be all sitting around having lunch, and everybody used to, talk and talk and talk, and then all of a sudden I just remember sitting there one day and everybody's doing this. They're just they're texting back and forth and all that. Yeah. And it was just things have changed. It's the technology has just exploded, I think.
And changed so many methods for law enforcement.
Right.
Just changed so much.
Right. I mean, even the laws now, the old, we call it the Title III laws and all that other stuff, is just with the new devices and everything else, those are written really for 70s technology, and a lot of them need significant upgrading, or you're trying to get a judge to kind of make a judgment on something about whether this really fits within the wiretap law or not, or some of the other stuff you're trying to get into.
Because now it's so complex. It's all, as you said, it's on the internet. It's their cell phone. It's their, Snapchat. It's all kinds of records.
And, the major companies, Facebook and a lot of them, they try to do a good job. They've actually got probably retired law enforcement and actually working there, But as far as the subpoena service and everything, but everything requires a subpoena. They're good at catching. If somebody's transmitting child porn, they're usually pretty good about getting that, filtering it out, and sending it to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. But, at the same time, there's just so much of it out there. And then, when we get into the Onion Router Tor, and then really what they call the dark web, a lot of that stuff that we call P2P, point-to-point transmission of stuff, a lot of it is, there's just some really dark stuff out there.
I just want to, before we run out of time, talk about the international. There's so much, and you've had such experience. We're talking, by the way, to Peter Orchard, who is a former supervising special agent for the FBI. And you've had so much experience. I'm sure our listeners would like, and so would I, and like so would Jim, who's sitting here, to know what the mission is, like when the FBI agent or the FBI is in Afghanistan, for example. What is your role? What is your mission there?
Well, let me highlight first. In a traditional legal attaché, all right, it could be, a three-man office in Tbilisi, Georgia, to, a large office, like London's our largest legal attaché. At the time I was over there, Kabul was our largest. In the war zones, so Afghanistan and Iraq, those legal attachés were much bigger, and you had a bigger counterterrorism presence over there, and there's a lot working with DOD. Special operators would grab guys off the battlefield, high value targets, significant players in Al-Qaeda or whatever, and our guys would have a chance, with interrogation support and all the other stuff. It's just a lot quicker to get the information there and then send it back here, and we got this guy's phone. And he's got a 716 area code phone number in it. Why? Why does an Al-Qaeda operative on the battlefield in Iraq have a 716 area code? Issues like that. It just allows stuff to go a lot quicker. So those leagues were a lot bigger at the time. They're back to what we call normal size now. But there was so many other programs over there. Because of the money that was being poured into Afghanistan, you had a huge contract corruption issue. You had so many contractors over there, and there was, you know, the normal age-old American solution to everything is we just throw money at it. Well, you're throwing so much money into Afghanistan, and, you know, contractors are making out on it, but there was a lot of contractor fraud. So they had a whole task force over there just for contractor fraud. They had other areas where we were what we called the Major Crimes Task Force, where we would work trying to train their officers and their police forces into, you know, how to work big crimes, how to be a, you know, a professional police force, that type of stuff. Just a whole myriad of different programs over there. So you had different agents going over. You know, we had bomb technicians going over there with, you know, with a number of bombs that would go off on a daily basis. So just a whole myriad of different folks over there. So.
And was it, do you feel it was worthwhile?
Oh, it was. I can't say enough about it. I think we did a lot of good over there. A lot of stuff I can't talk about what we did over there, but I think
we
did.
We want you to.
Yeah.
come on.
We did. There's a whole lot of good going on in both countries. And it, you know, I was over there really when the surge was in 2011-2012. It was when they first said, "Hey, we're going to be sending a bunch of guys over to Afghanistan." I said, "There's no way in the world." I go, "The Bureau's too risk adverse. I mean, it's not going to do it," and everything else. And next thing I know, I'm on a, you know,
on a plane.
I'm catching a C-130 out of Kuwait, and you know, but it's a different experience over there. You really learn. There are a lot worse places to live in the world than the United States. So I think a lot of people always complain about it. I ought to go some of these other places.
Or as people keep saying, people are not trying to leave the United States. People are trying to come to the United States, get into the United States. So there must be a reason. When you said all of this pretty much was a result of 9/11, I don't know if you want to say it's been successful, but all the training, all the activities, all the law enforcement working together, it has been successful in the sense that there has, like you said, the main issue, the main target was not to be a target. The main objective was not to be a target again ever in the United States.
Yeah, I think the coordination, and a lot of people don't realize, I mean, there were certain laws in place that didn't allow like the criminal side to share with the, you know,
before,
with the intelligence side.
Before
9/11. And there was really strict rules in place about what you could share with local law enforcement. Well, local law enforcement, that's your best eyes on the ground. These guys are out in their neighborhoods every day. They see everything. They're the ones that are getting the 911 calls. They're the ones that are getting, you know, all the check the welfare calls, all that stuff. That's your backbone of any what I call successful defense. And I think that coordination, especially with the, you know, with all the different task forces and everything else, I think it's increased 100%. I mean, 100-fold. I think it's a lot better now, and I think kind of it speaks for themselves. I hate to use the term lone wolf, but I mean, if you have one person who got radicalized in his basement and decided to go take a car and mow a bunch of people down the sidewalk, there's not a lot you can do with it. I mean, generally guys get caught because they talk, you know, or they brag, or, you know,
or they put something on the internet or on their phone, or, you know.
And then see people say, well, you know,
Facebook.
We might have seen the guy. A guy's name might have popped up, you know, for some radical websites and stuff like that. But again, you know, you have serious constitutional rights that you have to always balance. You just can't go out and willy-nilly. It's not like NCIS or, you know, one of the other TV shows where, you know, I watched the one TV show and they're tracking the guy's car and his cell phone, and I counted the amount of legal process required for what they did in literally 2 minutes on the TV show. I mean, it was like 3 search warrants, you know, 4 grand jury subpoenas, and, you know, he did it all off his iPad. Okay, the world just doesn't work that way.
And it's the same with DNA when in the TV programs.
Right.
They'll get the DNA, and then in 2 seconds later, they'll say, "Oh, it's so-and-so." And as we know, it doesn't work that way.
Or if you go into the lab and it's perfectly clean, it's the only single case that they are working on that day.
On TV. So. A lot of this, by the way, as we said, ended up in training for not just law enforcement people and cooperation with law enforcement, but what we were talking about before, training, active shooter training, that people in schools and businesses and so forth became so much more aware of the danger and are now really trained on what to do, how to react.
I think there's two main areas to look at. One is law enforcement. As law enforcement after Columbine, that was a major shift in the way law enforcement reacted to an active shooter. Before Columbine, everybody, including the FBI, you treat it like a hostage situation. Surround the building,
get
you know,
the
make sure and all
don't
that,
go
and
in.
Then you go in with a SWAT team and the whole nine yards. You don't have time because the guy's killing people. So that caused a major shift. And when you get there. We'll call an active shooter instructor, and have taught multiple agencies. It's a major shift, and now they're teaching that same thing in the academies before they come up. So, I don't think there's a law enforcement officer out there now that doesn't know the procedures for reacting to an active shooter. But the other side of it is the people who are getting shot at. And it basically comes down to the run, hide, fight. Schools are a little different. They have a little bit different procedures, but pretty much every school has their lockdown procedures and how they're going to deal with an active shooter. But teaching the employees, it's really the biggest thing I emphasized with our employees was just you got to think about this a little bit. All right? I don't want you to worry about it. The chances are less than 1% that this is ever going to happen to you. Problem is, if it is happening to you, it's 100%. So what are you going to do? If you're going to run, you're sitting at your desk, look around. Where are you going to run to? If you're going to hide, where are some good places to hide? Under your desk probably isn't the best place. And then lastly, if you're going to fight, what are you going to fight with? And that's what it comes down to. We try to do it from the workspace where they're actually sitting at work, not just give them a lecture and show up nice PowerPoint slides and everything else.
So. Yeah, I'm sure that works a lot better.
But I think a lot of people pretty much know the run, hide, fight. Mm-hmm. It's just but when you're really scared,
you have to
sometimes
see if
people don't remember.
Remember it. I knew you were going to say that. Yeah. Well, we'll remember talking to you, Peter. Thank you so much for everything. And it went so fast. We ran out of time. But we've been talking to Peter Orchard. And you've been listening to On Target with your host, Penny Wolfgang. And we hope you're going to join us again next week for more information and for another program. Please be with us next week. Same time, same station. Have a good week. And goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to On Target with Penny Wolfgang, a program that takes an inside look at Western New York and our community. If you have any comments or suggestions, please write to Penny Wolfgang at 500 Corporate Parkway, Suite 200, Amherst, New York, 14226.